Hey everybody, what's up? It's Larry from Iowa here, and we are a few days into 2021, so I would like to wish everyone a happy new year. New episodes are on the way for 2021. They're coming very soon, but until then, I'm going to hold you guys off with a little something special here. We've got the best of The Only Chip in the Cookie Season 1. These are a few clips from all 10 of the main episodes of our first season. I've got some really good clips on here. So if you are a new follower of the podcast and maybe you haven't had an opportunity to listen to all 10 episodes, or if you've been rocking with us for a while and want to relive some of the classic moments of The Only Chip in the Cookie, bam, here's your opportunity. So again, I want to thank everybody for being a supporter of the podcast, being a supporter of the movement. I want to thank all the allies that are learning about their coworkers, their team members, their teammates, their neighbors of color, and trying to make a difference and enhance their lives and learn more about one another. I want to thank you guys for supporting the podcast, whether it's through merchandise or the one-off donations here and there. Thank you very much. We've got a lot of awesome things in store for season two. We've got some awesome guests line up. We've got some guest hosts, and I'm going to let you guys in on a little bit of a teaser here. We might even have a new co-host. Hey. Anyway, thanks a lot, you guys, and enjoy the best of The Only Chip in the Cookie season one.
Welcome back to The Only Chip in the Cookie podcast. We are witnessing something great. Actually, we're not witnessing. We are experiencing something incredible right now, something historical, something groundbreaking. We have our very first guest on the show. It's another chocolate chip. So now it's two chips in the cookie. This gentleman certainly has his own experiences and his own stories about being the only chip in the cookie. So everybody give a warm round of applause to my man, Coach J, the sensei. What's going on, Coach J?
What's up, man? Thank you. You're far too kind. I always wanted to hit somebody with my Jay-Z joint. I'm doing good, man. How are you?
A fellow Ho fan, of course. Yeah. I'm doing good, brother. I'm doing good. Man, thanks a lot for joining the podcast, Coach J. You are our very first guest on the show, man, and I appreciate that.
It's such an honor, man. I listened to your show, bro. I listened to that first episode, man, and I just smiled the whole time, bro. I thought that, I think you're dope, man. And yeah, so I'm excited to be here.
Man, I really appreciate that, Coach J. So Coach J, so today, man, we're talking about situation. We're talking about school, actually, right? And today we're talking about being the only black kid in class, or being one of the few black kids in the school when it's Black History Month and everybody wants to look at you and all that stuff. You grew up in a small town in Iowa, right?
I did.
Yeah.
Keokuk.
Tell us about Keokuk.
Man, Keokuk is... Man, it's a little more diverse than people think.
Yeah.
But not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, my experience growing up there was overall, man, I mean, obviously I got a lot of family members and good people I love there. But there are some things that happen, bro, often, man, that people acted like didn't happen. You know, we just happen to live right on the border of Missouri, too.
Which,
yeah, I mean, like, you could just drive across the bridge, and Missouri's right there. And also, if you drove across the bridge in Illinois, Carthage, I think Warsaw, I think, I know it's Carthage and Warsaw, but it's counties. They were sundown towns. Have you ever heard of that?
Enlighten me, my brother.
Yeah, so a sundown town is a town who has an ordinance that if you're black and you're caught in that town when the sun is down, you could be arrested, you could be harmed, whatever it is.
Wow.
No black ass better not be in that town when it's sundown. And I think Carthage, it was 2008 when that was finally removed. And maybe, and see, I didn't know that back then. I didn't know that. I didn't know what a sundown town was. I figured that out as an adult. What the story was back then, for like, that was told to us, like black kids by our families.
Yeah.
Don't have y'all's ass over there after dark.
Right.
Like, get y'all's ass home.
Right.
Like, get on home, man. Like, so you can't be over there.
That's not crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. You know what, man? I had a feeling you were going to say something like that with sundown.
Yeah.
Man. So, did you ever have any tense moments in school because you were so close to communities that had those types of reputations?
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were kids in our school who were blatantly racist, and some of them's parents had a lot of influence within our schools or within our communities. So, you know, and when that happens, bro, you kind of feel helpless. To one day, I mean, that's one part of it, to one day walking out of school and my cousin's car has nigger spray painted all over it and the windows busted.
Dang.
Yeah. Now, this is probably a dumbass statement to make, but I don't know what he had done or if he had done anything, but why nigger? Like,
right.
Why?
Yeah.
Why all that, man?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy how, people can just let that fly so freely. It's like,
yeah.
Wow, you know, and it's some people just have a license to hate. Like,
yeah.
Like it's just, yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. So, you know, I kind of, the first time I was called a nigger, was in, at school. And a situation where, you know, I was the only only black kid in class, and definitely, you know, not many black folks in the entire school. And I was waiting for the bus, and these two kids, they're white, and they were laughing and pointing at me, and one of them said it. He pointed at me, and he said it. And I was in kindergarten. I didn't know what that word meant, but I could tell that it was just different. I could tell that it was even different from any other swear word that I had heard. You know what I mean?
Felt like it, huh?
Yeah, you know, like, wait, what? Like, it was weird. And then, like, and the weird thing, too, is, like, I automatically felt, like, isolated, kind of. Well, like, when they just singled me out and called me that. Like, it was weird.
And that was the moment you felt different?
Yeah. Like right there, bam. 6 years old. 5 or 6 years old. I was in kindergarten. I was always one of the only black kids, and I always got called the N-word.
I was hoping that we could bring in an expert here to help us kind of get a better understanding of how our local government works for us and just what we can do to better align ourselves with allies. So without any further ado, that was a pretty lengthy introduction. Without any further ado, give it up for my man, Isaiah McGee. What's going on, Isaiah?
What's going on, Larry? I appreciate you having me on, and congratulations on getting this thing started here.
Hey, no problem, man, and I appreciate it. And so Isaiah, first things first, man. So the name of this podcast is The Only Chip in the Cookie.
Yep.
And it's one of those names that I was hoping could kind of go without an explanation. You know, you either get it or you don't, right?
Yeah.
So before we really jump into all of these political questions that I have for you and all that stuff, I gotta ask, man, can you share with me maybe some experiences that you've had where you were the only one?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I think the topic at hand that we're going to be talking about here today, and the overall broad scope of your podcast, I think they're intertwined, or they're very closely related, because that is my experience. You know, I grew up in L.A., in South Central L.A. during the time of NWA and Tupac and the L.A. riots and the O.J. Simpson trial. And all that type of stuff. And then I came out to Iowa because I was fortunate enough to be decent enough in sports that I used that as an opportunity to go to college. So I went to a small college in eastern Iowa, moved out to Colorado for a couple of years, and then came back to Iowa to go to grad school. So all of my professional career, most of my professional career has been where I've been that one cookie, or I've been that one chocolate chip in the cookie.
Yeah.
So I get it. I understand what you're talking about. And I think that's been really, for me, my perspective, along the type of work that I do now. I didn't start off wanting to necessarily do diversity work or be a diversity consultant or anything like that. I actually, tried to avoid it. But as I continue to look at the way society is structured and opportunities for me, and how I saw myself and some of the barriers to that, and the barriers for other people, and how we are always looking to create opportunities, but it's typically at the expense of being able to be our full and authentic selves. That's where I got started getting more involved in doing the work that I do now, which is how to confront these inequities and try to work with people on both the interpersonal ways to deal with those, but also systemically what we can do to dismantle that as well.
Yeah, man, I actually related quite a bit to what you said there. I never thought in a million years that I would want to pursue that path either. I always thought I was going to be either a bank manager forever, or, you know, maybe human resources. But I think the more I experience certain inequities, you know, the more it kind of motivated me to kind of dig a little bit deeper and find out why those things are happening. And now I'm to the point where it's like, okay, I need to take these experiences and take these tools that I'm discovering and do something with this. And you're absolutely right. And like I said earlier, I mean, you've been down this path for a while now, certainly setting the way for brothers like me to even realize that's even a possibility, to even pursue that kind of thing. So that's awesome. So like I said, you know, when I met you, you know, speaking of diversity stuff, so I was working for a company at the time, and I believe there was something being sponsored by the local NAACP, and it was one of those situations where it was like, hey, you're the black dude that works for the company. We need you to go here and represent us, right? And me being, you know, 21 years old, I kind of just did whatever. I ended up going to this function. You were there. And so not only did I see another chip in the cookie, But we also, this event, I believe it was either in the suburb that we lived in, or perhaps you were just talking about where you were from.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was, yeah. you mentioned where you were from, and I kind of remember doing a double take, because I was like, I thought there was only two of us, and then,
yeah.
and the other one I knew lived around the corner from me, so
right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
So I think I was super excited about that when I heard that, and
same.
I think that's been the most interesting experience for me has been, and this is why I say everywhere I go now, I have the good fortune of being able to travel around the country now doing this work, and oftentimes I find myself in places that are largely and predominantly white,
mm-hmm.
and I remind them, it's like there's always, even in some of the most white spaces, there are people of color there, mm-hmm. and their experience matters to them. And you'll hear me say this a lot, but our perspectives are birthed from our experiences. So the way that we see the world comes from the way that we experience the world.
Yeah.
And so when you're a person of color, it doesn't matter. How we go about trying to integrate or assimilate into the culture or the environment that we're in. The old saying is when in Rome, do as the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
None of that matters, because it doesn't matter what your philosophy or your perspective on that is. There are still people who look at you differently. And because of the way that they look at you differently, they are placing you into a certain box. And because of that box, they have ascribed a certain value to your experience.
Yeah.
So that's where the problem typically comes in. It's not that they necessarily think that you have to do things their way, but mm-hmm. when you don't do things in that particular way, is there a devaluing of that experience? Is there, do they look at your experience and your perspective from that experience and say that it is inferior to the experiences that they've had? And many people will say, "Oh, absolutely not. I don't think that."
Mm-hmm.
But we, as a part of our nature, is to seek comfort. And so, as we're seeking out comfort, then that's how we're going to make decisions. When we're hiring people, when we're associating with people, when we're all these different types of things that we're doing, we look at and say, "I trust people who have similar experiences to me."
Right.
And if I trust them, then I'm willing to give them more of the benefit of the doubt compared to someone who I have a harder time relating to or understanding their experience. So yeah. I don't think most people, there are people who definitely do look at someone and say, "Oh, that person's black," or "that person's brown," or "that person's a person of color, and I don't like them simply because of that." There are people that are like that, but that's not the majority of people. The problem really is, when we talk about systemic racism, it's how we look at and say, "I'm more comfortable around this environment with these people who have similar experiences to me compared to folks that do not have the same experiences or perspectives that I do."
I'm more comfortable. I'm more inviting. I'm more accepting. I'm more likely to hire. I'm more likely mm-hmm. to promote. Yeah. It all kind of circles around that, that comfort level kind of dictates your willingness to give someone else an opportunity.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely. And
sure.
And so then the end result of that becomes these inequities that we see, where I always remind people, like when people talk about like the violence that's going on in society right now, geared mm-hmm. towards Black people, mainly in the hands of folks that are charged with enforcing the law, and then the reaction that we've seen recently to that, the issue isn't, sometimes it's framed up as, well, you know, there's just this, there are a few bad apples. It's not an issue of there being a few more, there's more bad apples than I think we realize. That's the first thing. But the question I throw out is, how do you determine what's good and what's bad?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take the stance of, well, sometimes, you know, good people do bad things, the inverse is also true, and that is that sometimes bad people do good things.
Yeah.
And so how do you determine What makes a person fully good or fully bad? We all do good things and bad things. George Washington owned slaves, was not very good to his slaves. At the same time, he was a masterful politician, was a masterful military leader. And so how do we determine then that person's legacy? What we do is we have to incorporate all of it. We have to look at it holistically and take the good and the bad. And we can't sugarcoat one or the other.
Can I just say one thing about George Washington? When I was in first grade, I went to Mount Vernon, and we were given a tour, of course, of the whole plantation. And there was a part, and I was with my family, there was a part where we got to like this, we were in one of the cabins and or one of the houses or whatever. There was this rocking chair contraption kind of thing, and it had a whip attached to the back of it and a pedal on the front of it. So if a slave needed to get whooped, it could literally from the comfort of this rocking chair, press its foot down like a gas pedal, and this whip would come from behind the chair and over the top of it and whip the slave, right? And I remember when the tour guy was describing that, like the room kind of erupted in laughter. And I'm freaking 6 years old, and bro, I've hated George Washington ever since. As I scroll through Facebook, I'm feeling like there are probably some conversations that we need to have. So the first point that I would like to address, this black on black crime thing. I can't think of a single black person that thinks that the violence that is happening in some of our communities thinks that that is okay. But here's why I bring this up. A lot of y'all weren't really talking about quote unquote black on black crime until we started to make some noise about a separate issue, which was the treatment and the brutalization of African Americans at the hands of police. That is the main issue that we have been bringing to the, I shouldn't say that we've been bringing to the forefront, but that has been an issue that we have been rallying for and protesting for. When you guys hit us with the what about black on black crime stuff, first of all, to position it in that way is offensive. And here's why. You're making the assumption that there aren't people, that there aren't black people in these communities that aren't making noise, that aren't trying to do something to end or curtail the violence in these communities. There are lots of organizations, there are lots of individuals that are doing what they can to uplift these communities. Another thing that you probably don't understand is that a lot of these communities are deprived of a lot of resources that nicer neighborhoods or suburban communities have. And so when you have a community that is lacking of resources necessary to feed your family, to pay your bills, or to have access to mental health, or have access to healthy food, or have access to adequate healthcare, man, the culture of poverty is something else, and it can lead to people resolving issues in a way that you might not necessarily resolve them in. And so I'm not saying any of this to justify any of the horrendous murders that happen in black communities, but I am saying it's really not fair for you to make this assumption that nobody cares and that nobody is doing anything about it. What you have to understand is that when you turn on NBC or Fox News or CNN or any of these news networks and you see all of this footage about the protests and about Black Lives Matter and things like that, you have to understand that it's not typically black people in those control rooms that are publishing these stories. Because if you were to follow any black media at all, you will see that there are constant organizations where their founders have made it their life missions to end the violence, to provide resources that are going to lead to less destruction and less violence in these communities. You will see that there's lots of organizations that have been created to teach folks about financial literacy. You know, in fact, I'm on the board of a nonprofit that specifically aims to put books in the hands of poor Black and Brown kids in my community, right? So I know firsthand that there's lots of us that are looking for the solutions and looking to end some of these problems that are happening in Black communities. Okay, so if you are so perturbed by the things that are happening in Black communities, I'm gonna need you to step your game up. I'm gonna need you to look up which local elected officials in these neighborhoods that you are so concerned about. I'm going to need you to do your research and figure out how politically or how with policy we can make change so that those communities have a remedy for some of those issues sooner. There are many ways for you to put your concern into action. But when we are talking about an issue, when we are talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, which, by the way, Black Lives Matter as an organization and as a movement does not condone violence of any kind to any Black person, regardless if it's by a cop or by another Black person. So if you really knew about BLM, then you would stop saying things like Black Lives only matter when it's a cop on a Black person. You know, Black lives don't matter when it's Black people on Black people. We got to stop with that. And I've heard that from Black folks and from white folks. And that's simply not true. It's a racist thing to say. And by perpetuating that belief, you are perpetuating racism. And here's why I call it racist. So we say Black on Black. I need y'all to Google where the phrase Black on Black crime comes from, because surprise, guys, there's a reason why you never hear the term Asian on Asian crime or Latino on Latino crime, or I'm sorry, Latinx on Latinx crime or white on white crime. Black people kill other Black people at virtually the same rate that white people kill other white people, that Latinx kill other Latinx, that Asians kill Asians, and so on and so on. Okay, so let me repeat that. Blacks are killing Blacks at the same ratio that whites are killing whites. And no one ever says we got to do something about this white on white crime. So when people are killing each other at the same ratio, essentially, what it means is that when you have an issue with someone in your neighborhood, you're probably going to take that issue out with someone in your neighborhood. Take all this Black on Black stuff out of your vocabulary. It does not make sense. It's offensive. It's insensitive.
We have to work in a system. And yeah. In order to work within a system, you have to understand how it works.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You got it. So I'm like, yo, I'll talk, but y'all got to listen first. And you know what? And I found that a lot of people have taken me up on that. You know, a lot of people have like, yeah, you know, and I've actually I've had a lot of conversations with folks lately where it's ended with, wow, I never looked at it like that. I never thought of it like that.
That's very encouraging. Wow. To
hear. Man, it makes me feel great, honestly. And these kinds of conversations do not happen online, for the record. These are face-to-face conversations. These are people that, for whatever reason, I've been able to, you know, give them that safe feeling, that approachable feeling or whatever, which, All right, cool. I get what that's all about, but I'm going to use my powers for good. So I'm going to use my, that approachableness to talk about and to tell the truth about the Black issues and the stuff that's affecting our communities and our people and our children and stuff like that. Yeah. So, But no, it's been great. It's been cool. Like, you know, just been able to help, change some perspectives. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. I can't necessarily say that I've had that same experience, but I can also say that I really have time
for
people to, and some people have that deep-rooted patience to deal and talk and explain, and I'm to the point where I'm just like, look.
You either get it or you don't.
You agree or you don't agree.
Yep. Yep.
You either acknowledge that systemic racism is a problem and permeates our entire society, or you don't.
Yes.
And whichever one of those you are is really, really fine.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm not going to talk about this. So if you do, then we can talk. And if you don't, then we're done here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the place where I've had to come to for my sort of sanity. My spouse is not Black, so I am the only chip in the cookie in my home also.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the way that my social media is structured, so actors on the whole do tend to skew liberal, at least socially.
Yeah.
Maybe some weirdo fiscal Republicans, like with money, but like with social issues and abortion and gay rights, overwhelmingly actors are for all of those things.
Yeah.
And so I was seeing a lot of the fallout from the releasing of the George Floyd, a good 4 or 5 days before my spouse.
Mm.
And so I was all tense and like my shoulder blades were all tight, and I was just like so angry and sad and stressed out and all of this stuff. And so I started like asking people directly on social media, like, you can't, please don't. And I have a list of things that is, please don't anymore. Mm-hmm. Please don't post any snuff films without a warning. Please do not post any typed out death word monologues for me to read.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
Don't do that, because to you, like, I think to the average person, and maybe this is a function of my acting brain, but, like, those are words that someone literally just said, mm-hmm. and then those were the last things they ever said ever. So, yeah. Like, you're trying to, and a lot of my feed is white people. A lot of my friends and colleagues and coworkers and professionals mm-hmm. are all white people. And so they're just posting this stuff left and right, like, because it has such a visceral impact. Like, however you feel about it, you feel so strong and so fast whenever you see these images or hear this stuff or watch these videos. And so they're using it sort of as a hammer against other sort of tone-deaf, culturally insensitive, completely unaware white people who are, like, blithely swimming through their feed. And I'm like, you are tormenting me. This is traumatizing. Yeah. Because I work as the director of education for a regional theater, we have a Facebook presence, we have summer programming going on. I'm mm-hmm. required to be on Facebook for work. Mm-hmm. And the last thing that I want to do is see all of this stuff. So, like, you have to post it and tell me that this is what I'm about to see so I can scroll. Like, if you need that visceral hammer to change people's minds and to work on people and to get people to see the injustice of it, I understand completely.
Yeah.
What I don't need you to do it to me. So just let a girl know what it is. And I can scroll past, or there's a function on Facebook where you can make a post that, and the privacy settings are specific. And you can say, hey, show this post to everyone but Bethany Mayo. Great. Yeah. Cool. Do that. Because mm-hmm. I can't tolerate it. I just can't see it. I can't see it. I can't hear it. I can't read it. I've turned the news off in the middle of the broadcast. I've turned the radio off in the middle of it. I just, I just can't. I just can't deal with it.
I'm in the store. I'm greeted by no one, but I see Bubba, the cashier, standing over 6 feet tall and probably weighed around 300 pounds. He's up front behind the register laughing and joking with some folks as he's checking them out. So I collect the items that I was looking for, but I needed one more thing that wasn't in an obvious location. I needed fishing worms. I realized I was going to need to ask for assistance from the cashier. So I asked Maskless Bubba where I could find the fishing worms. He looks, he just kind of points in the direction that they're at. He drops his arm. I thought it was kind of weird that he didn't say anything and he just pointed. Bubba sure had a lot to say to the folks he was just ringing up. But all right. Anyway, so I go and I grab my night crawlers along with the other items and place them on the counter for purchase. Without uttering a single word, Bubba rings up my worms, my gloves, my plastic baggies, my aluminum foil. When my final total was displayed on the register, he just kind of tilted his head and pointed with his forehead of what the grand total was. And if this hasn't pinged you yet, is this motherfucker racist? Spider sense definitely is going off at this point. All right, well, hey, I got things to do. So I swipe my card. Approved. Bubba hands me the receipt without saying a single word. So through my mask, I say,
"Thank you very much, sir."
"Thank you very much, sir." And I'm meaning to be polite, but this is also a test to see if he's going to return the pleasantry or not. Guess what? No response. I walk out asking myself, does this guy have a problem with black people? Or does he just perform shitty customer service? Or maybe he has an issue with my mask. Because for whatever reason, masks are political now. I don't know. By the way, my mask is a black mask with a white smile painted across the lips. It's not a human rights statement. It's nothing political. It's a smile. And I specifically picked out that mask because I had some early apprehension about wearing a mask in public and being mistaken for a criminal. So I thought, let me get a mask that's right away that's going to be attention catching and maybe make people smile. But yeah, I just wanted to share that experience with y'all. Listen, racism, it's tricky as hell. You know when you are experiencing racism. Bubba didn't have to call you the N-word to feel its effects. Again, I know for a fact homie was capable of speaking and interacting and whatever. I heard him. I heard his voice. He sure had a whole lot to say to the patrons buying their fishing worms and Mountain Dews. When you're the only chip in the cookie, your spidey sense is always tingling. Thanks everyone for listening, and please, wear the damn masks, people.
Everybody's protesting on their own platform and in their own ways. And this podcast is, you know, its own form of protest in and of itself too. So, I mean, as long as people are doing something to activate the landscape or activate radio waves or activate their community and vacant lots, like as long as you're out doing something and in the form of protest or civil disobedience for long-term sustainable direct action, I think, you know, we're on the right course. And I really truly think that our kids are going to look back and see us as, you know, the summer of 68, you know, 69 into the 70s. Like, I really think it's going to be a historical time evolving of U.S. society. And honestly, I don't think it's by any means over in terms of the violence that's going to happen, because you'd already know what's going to happen with these elections with the Trumpers out there and cats picking up arms. I just saw last night on the news, man, with armed black citizens and armed white militia down in Arkansas, I think it was, that were standing off with everybody had assault rifles of different, you know, calibers and different makes and models.
Yeah.
You know, just staring at each other, like 50-50 on each side. And I'm like, I really feel like if one of them cats shot, like that would have sparked this huge violent racial conflict throughout the U.S. And we're, and I don't think we're out of the woods because I was just in the, at the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis after they burned the precinct down. And there were white supremacists walking all over, and there were white supremacists. This is well documented, with full-blown, you know, militia gear on, shooting into neighborhoods, into the ground, so military would go into black neighborhoods. So there's all this other shit happening, and I don't think we're out of the woods with that by any means, but I think that's going to be part of this, you know, evolution of, you know, us moving forward in some way, shape, or form. And like you said before, I really think our kids are going to look back and see it as you know, this 68 summer. For sure. I really do.
For sure, man. Yeah, we're definitely not out of the woods yet. So, my man, this is the only chip in the cookie podcast, right? So, I kind of want to take things in a different kind of a different direction, man. But you know, being from Des Moines, obviously you have ties here, right? So obviously your art is going to be on display here. I've been to a lot of your shows here in Des Moines. I think the biggest show of yours that I've been to was at the Art Gallery, right?
Yep.
And I remember, honestly, man, I remember thinking, you know, so before I went, I was thinking, okay, whoa, the Art Gallery, you know.
Oh, you're talking about the Des Moines Art Center. That's
the Art Center. The Art Center. That's the Art Gallery. Yeah, the Des Moines
Art Center. Yeah, because you and Nikhil came in. You and Kale came and held it down, so I specifically remember you at that one.
Yes, Art Center. But I just remember thinking, like, what is this experience going to be like? Because, you know, I know you as my mans, and you're the artist, but to me, I'm just going to be a black dude in the crowd. So what does a black dude wear to an art show? I don't know. And then of course, you know, and of course we get there and so obviously, you know, there's going to be a lot of white folks pretty much anywhere in Des Moines, right? Mm-hmm. So as you unveil and talk about and describe this black pain and some of these emotions, man, I gotta ask, man. Do things ever get kind of maybe uncomfortable for you, or does the room ever kind of get a little tense? You know, like specifically with the white folk.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you go to any art exhibition, the majority of them, the most uncomfortable person in the room is going to be the artist, because for one, we're butt naked because we have all of our, you know, everything that is trapped, you know, in a mental state floating around in our head, the most intimate of thoughts and things are on the wall, you know, so you're literally naked.
Yeah.
So that exhibition would be a lot different now, because like we were talking about before, we have more white allies now than we ever have in the past two decades. So in terms of this activist movement and police brutality. So at that exhibition, like, I needed y'all there because I was speaking to police brutality, and there was probably only 10 of us in the crowd of 90, right? So it is tense because I'm talking about black empowerment and police brutality to a group of white folks, and how do you do that in a way that's productive when, you know, 80-90% of the audience is white? It is tense. And I got word after that from a professor at Drake, and she said, oh, I didn't make it to the, you know, the talk, but, you know, I heard it was okay. Like, yeah, you heard it was okay, because I can't get into a huge discourse and an intimate discourse and a sea of white folks that are going to engage. You know, they're going to downplay the oppressive, you know, energy that we feel on a daily basis. So, like, for one, you know, fuck you for even mentioning that, because that was hella aggressive. And for two, like you don't even know what it's like to be speaking on blackness in a white space like that, in the most prolific space in Iowa for the arts. So it's tense because I'm sitting there making eye contact with the majority of white folks.
Yeah.
And if you could see when I was speaking at that lecture around the work, as we had a young brother by the name of Trey, who's about 280 pounds of muscle, lifting a cop car up and down as a piece of a weight equipment, that said NYC on one side of the cop car and Ferguson on the other side of the cop car. You know, I was gravitating towards that and the black audience and my black homeboys on the right-hand side. So it very much was a gravitational pull over to my comfort zone in that space, even though it is my show, right? So I think it was you and Akil both spoke, and you two were the only ones to speak when I asked if anybody had to anything to add to this conversation. I think one white cat spoke too, but I mean, you would have that, you know, times 10, I would assume, if we had that happen today, which we are. There's a show opening at the Des Moines Arts Center October 2nd, and COVID's really going to push it into a different space, but it's going to be all black and brown artists from the Des Moines Arts Center collection. And yeah, it's going to be a pretty prolific and intense exhibition for black artists in Des Moines. So we're going to be advertising that soon, but you'll see a whole different, you know, population at this show versus that one. So it's always difficult in Des Moines to speak about blackness to a sea of white and a sea of whiteness.
So when people out of nowhere or out of the blue would reach out to me with one of those, I would like to get your perspective openers, I had a tendency to ignore the request completely, because 9 times out of 10, I had a feeling in the back of my mind that this perspective that I was being asked to share would more likely be about black people or my feelings about black people. And I just did not have the stomach for those one-sided conversations. Fast forward to 2020, the George Floyd era. Like I've mentioned in previous episodes, white people have come out of the woodwork to reach out to me about blackness. But this time, for the most part, a lot of it has been simply to say, I see you, I'm thinking about you, thinking about your family. Obviously, some of these statements were more thought out, but this is the gist of the messaging that I was receiving. And I did receive some of those invitations to talk about my perspective. But again, for years, I trained myself to ignore requests, and I trained myself to not talk about race with white people. I'd been burned so many times putting myself out there, being vulnerable, only to experience being attacked for expressing my true black opinion on a black related matter. I guess I just figured there's enough YouTube videos and podcasts out there that do a good enough job sharing perspective. And plus, if you're friends with me on social media, then you should already know my perspective. Now I want to tell you about something extraordinary that happened to me. I want to tell you about the last time I received one of those, can I grab your perspective, emails. A few weeks ago, I received an email from a former colleague of mine asking for my perspective. I'm going to read you guys this email verbatim. Larry, I wonder if you have time for a call. I would love to get your perspective. Pause. Now, here we go. That perspective line. I'm already rolling my eyes and ready to just put my phone back down wherever it was. Unpause. I have been doing some research, starting before the recent disturbing stories we continually hear about in the news. For example, George Floyd, Rayshard Brooks, Breonna Taylor. These news stories, however, make this even more pressing / significant. All right, pause again. I'm going to give you guys basically a breakdown as I read this letter. But this is right here where the wheels in my brain started to turn. And I was like, oh, because now I'm hearing something that nobody has ever said this to me before. No one has ever followed up, can I get your perspective on some black stuff, with, by the way, this is some stuff that I've been doing on my own. And I thought it was dope that, like my former colleague said, this person was doing research on this particular issue prior to George Floyd, Rayshard Brooks, Breonna Taylor. I think that's big. And so for me, I'm like, okay, so if you've been doing the research, you and I have probably been noticing the same patterns. Unpause. I read a book entitled Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do, and another entitled White Fragility, Why Is It So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism? Both books were eye-opening. In short, I am trying to re-educate myself. Pause. Let me just pause right there. I am trying to re-educate myself, and not only have I been doing research, but I'm going to tell you exactly what books I've been reading. So again, no one's ever talked to me like this before. This is making me feel pretty good. Unpause. Both books were eye-opening. In short, I am trying to educate myself. I want to learn as much as I can, and then I will try to figure out what I can do to improve or reduce the amount of racism in the conversations and relationships I have. I want to do my part. The point of a call would be merely to get your perspective. I understand now that there is a lot of racism around us, and I would like to understand it better and do what I can to improve. I guess I am not so bold as to think I can change the world, but maybe I can help to change my corner of it. Are you game? If so, I will set up a meeting. Thanks. When I received this email, I honestly was in shock. I thought if there's any way to lead the I would like to get your perspective conversation, this would be the way to do it. So what happened next? I accepted the invite. This person sent me an agenda. The agenda was very specific, much like the original invite. We had the conversation. The conversation was great. I had an opportunity to share my thoughts, my perspective, how my perspective was shaped. It was a great conversation. And I realized, okay, it is possible for me to have these kinds of conversations with people that approach me, but it just has to be done in the right way. And I really appreciate how this person was sensitive to the subject matter and, you know, came to me respectfully to talk about a very delicate situation. Out of all the black kids and biracial kids at the school, D'Angelo and I were probably the only ones who looked like we came straight from the pages of a Vibe magazine. So what do you think I did? I had this epiphany, and here's a summary of that epiphany. If it ain't white, it ain't right. I thought, well, maybe if I can show them that we are more alike than different, the student body will respect me more and I'll have less issues. So I cut my hair. I took off my L chain and I put on my seashell necklace. My pants got tighter and I switched out my Lugs boots for Doc Martens. No more FUBU for me. The emblem was like a walking target on my chest. By now, if I wasn't rocking Ralph Lauren, then I was wearing Nautica. I would have worn Tommy Hilfiger, but both black people and white people alike told me that I wasn't allowed to wear his clothing. Black people told me I couldn't wear Tommy because supposedly he was a racist, and the white kids at school said that I couldn't wear Tommy because that's why FUBU was invented. I switched up the gear, but it wasn't enough. I had to fully assimilate. My dad had a couple of vocabulary books in his office. Why? Perhaps he was trying to assimilate as well. You see, my dad came from the south side of Chicago. Stateway Gardens. Google it. He also spent a number of years living down south while in the army. He definitely picked up an interesting accent mixed with both southern dialect and Chicago speak. Perhaps he was trying to eliminate some of his Chicagoisms to make the transition from army life into civilian life / corporate America. He once told me after he got his job with the state of Iowa in 1996 that his manager confessed to him that he thought the name on his resume belonged to a white man. I can only imagine the other kinds of bullshit statements he would hear at his job for the next 21 years of his life. Anyway, if my words were making me blacker, then perhaps I needed to learn new, whiter words. All I wanted was a fair chance of being treated like everyone else. I wanted these white kids to know that my parents were just as well off as theirs. I was tired of people being surprised that I lived in the same neighborhood as them. I thought, the more they respect me, the less they'll question me so much. Overnight, I went from being the Fresh Prince to Carlton Banks. But damn, now I'm being referred to as Carlton Banks. Almost instantaneously, I went from being called Thug Life to being referred to as the whitest black guy I know. By the way, to my white listeners, if you are telling your black friends that they are the whitest black person that you know, that's racist. Being the whitest black guy that they knew definitely was not the vibe I was going for. To this day, when people refer to me as a Carlton, which has actually happened to me within the last 12 months, I check them real quick. What up, my nigga? Yep. Don't think I'm just going to sit up here and talk about my experience at a white school without mentioning the blatant racism that I dealt with as well. The N-word was used a lot, and I'm talking hard R. I definitely had my fair share of, can I say nigga around you? Hell no. Okay, but what if it's in a song? Man, no. Well, if it's such a bad word, why do rappers use it in every rap song? Well, not all rappers, I'd say. The hard R's, N-I-G-G-E-R, were frequent as well. D'Angelo and I referred to as niggers when their white girlfriends wanted to hang out with us and not them. Walking home from the mall sometimes meant people from high school shouting, nigger, as they zoomed off in their pickup trucks. Some kids would actually say nigger in casual conversation just to see if they could get a rise out of me or D'Angelo. I remember one time, this kid named Justin, who lived on my street, used to sometimes drive me to school, and he yelled out nigger out the car window at another vehicle for cutting him off in traffic. I remember he looked at me and he apologized, but he didn't really seem very apologetic at all. That was the very last time I ever let him give me a ride to school, and to this day, I kind of want to kick his ass. You know what I find odd? Not one white person ever defended me or my friends from these types of attacks. If I would have been at Hoover in Des Moines, I promise you that our white friends and white allies would be ready to knuckle up against anybody, white or black, that was talking racist crap. With Brian Urlacher, a former Chicago Bear and proud hair plug recipient, shared this statement on social media. Brett Favre played the Monday Night Football game the day his dad died, threw 4 touchdowns in the first half, and was a legend for playing in the face of adversity. NBA players boycott the playoffs because a dude reaching for a knife wanted on a felony sexual assault warrant was shot by police. Now, when I read this, 2 things came to mind immediately. One, this totally reminded me of Laura Ingraham's now infamous shut up and dribble quote. And 2, the fact is, the world of sports as we know it would not exist today had it not been for athletes speaking up for what is right and shedding light on the injustices that are affecting their communities and our country. I would like to use my platform to shed light on the history of activism within sports. So, shut up and listen. Not only did Jackie Robinson break the color barrier for Major League Baseball, but he also became a civil rights leader. In 1958, he organized and led the Youth March for Integrated Schools with Dr. King by his side. People close to Jackie Robinson told him not to do it. They said it would be bad for his image. The protests drew 10,000 students from all over the country to Washington, D.C. By the way, did you know that Jackie Robinson was not the first black man to play in the big leagues? Google it. In 1961, Bill Russell and the other black members of the Boston Celtics were refused service at a restaurant in Kentucky prior to an exhibition game in that state. So what'd they do? They boycotted the game. Back then, black folk were just supposed to accept being treated as second class, and so this was a really big deal. In 1965, when black football players arrived in New Orleans to play in the AFL All-Star Game, they were treated poorly because of their race. Taxicabs refused to pick them up from airports. Hotels wouldn't honor their requests. The AFL made a bold protest, canceling the game in New Orleans, and instead, they played in Houston. In 1967, the champ, Muhammad Ali, refused to join the army when he was drafted to fight in the Vietnam War. As a conscientious objector, Ali's stance against the war were due to his religious beliefs. Our beloved Muhammad Ali was convicted of draft evasion and sentenced to 5 years in prison. He was stripped of his heavyweight title. And we all love Muhammad Ali, right? In 1968, during the Olympics, after Tommy Smith and John Carlos won gold and silver, respectively, they stepped onto the podium and they raised their fists and bowed their heads to silently protest racial discrimination. Our guy Bill Walton, who played basketball for UCLA, took part of a large demonstration on his college campus to protest Richard Nixon and the war in Vietnam. 1973, March 8th, the 8 members of the all-black cheerleading squad for Brown University refused to stand for the national anthem before a game against Providence College because they felt that the flag no longer represented them. Tennis great Arthur Ashe protested apartheid in South Africa. He played a tennis match over there in 1973. And he negotiated that the audience be allowed to be integrated for the match. Rest in peace, John Thompson. On January 14, 1989, Georgetown basketball coach John Thompson walked off the court before a home game against Boston College. Why? He was protesting a new NCAA rule, Proposition 42, that denied scholarships to freshmen who were academically ineligible. NCAA actually has a long history of pulling stunts to minimize the impact that black athletes were having in college sports. Did you know at one point the NCAA banned slam dunking basketballs? Who do you think was dunking basketballs back then? Exactly. Both the dunk ban and Prop 42 were rescinded. I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. That was Colin Kaepernick in 2016. The San Francisco 49ers quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, refused to stand for the national anthem before his preseason debut. After a conversation with Nate Boyer, a former Green Beret and NFL player, Colin was inspired to kneel instead of sitting on the bench to show respect while still silently protesting. By the way, the protest mentioned earlier by the Milwaukee Bucks took place 4 years to the day after Cap first enacted his silent protest. Roger Goodell, NFL commissioner, recently said, "I wish we had listened earlier to Cap, to what you were kneeling about and what you were trying to bring attention to." And these are just a few examples of the many athletes who have used their platform to stand up for injustices. Athletes who have shaped and molded the sports that you all love and have been watching your whole lives. I hope you guys learned something today. Since then, I've made it my mission to work with leadership in recognizing the racist pitfalls that are all too common on the job. Are you still with me? Great, because you're on your way to becoming a great ally. As I said earlier in this conversation, the first step to positioning yourself to be a better ally to the team you support really is to look inward. And this is what I mean. First, you've got to educate yourself. Educate yourself on racism and its many forms. I know racism is racism, but as Meek Mill said, there's levels to this. You see, a lot of people, managers and leaders included, have a belief or rather a misunderstanding that racism is blatant, like when someone blatantly refers to somebody else as a racial slur, or when someone makes a general put down about someone of a different race. The truth is, institutional racism, systemic racism, and racism's other forms are sneaky snakes. If these definitions and understandings aren't on your radar, then what's to prevent them from taking place in the office? The other thing you need to do is take inventory of your own inner biases. Why is this important? Because the way you feel about a particular group of people will dictate how you lead and manage them. A lot of the biases that we reserve towards specific groups usually tie back to racist stereotypes and generalizations and are not rooted in truth. I'm almost afraid to suggest this, but take some of the stereotypes that you've subscribed in the past. For example, these people are great dancers, or these people are terrible drivers, and Google where the origins of these stereotypes came from. You will find that the origins to a lot of these biases we've subscribed to were created originally to keep that group from reaching a certain level of power or influence or basic human rights. Now, my grandmother used to always say, "Don't start none, won't be none." Although silence is typically the enemy of the anti-racist, here are some examples of what not to say at work or really anywhere. You gotta get away from, "I don't see color." Ugh. The reality is, we do not live in a utopia and we don't work in them either.
So to say you don't see color diminishes the experiences unique to members of your team. It dismisses and discredits their points of view. Race is a man-made social construct, but its effects on our society are all too real. Something else you can cease from saying immediately, all lives matter. Just like with colorblind, this retort to Black Lives Matter only minimizes and ignores the realities that Black people in this country are faced with every day. Having a hard time with this one? Well, think of it like this. If you're sad because your grandmother just passed from cancer, wouldn't it be strange or insensitive for me to say, well, all diseases matter? If you break your arm and your arm needs a cast, you're not going to tell your doctor that all bones matter, are you? No. Refrain from treating your employee who is a person of color as the subject matter expert of their race. Your employees may open up on their own about their experiences, but everyone's view is shaped on their own unique perspective. Sure, we may have some general curiosities over particular cultures and how and why they do things and things like that, but unless that person is open and outwardly talks about those kinds of things, there are plenty of other resources out there for you to learn more about somebody's culture. A lot of the companies that you all are working for have recently taken bold stances against racism and have pledged to hold their organizations accountable for curating more equitable and inclusive workspaces. As leaders, you'll find that stepping your game up with better support to your BIPOC personnel, attrition will go down, employee satisfaction will go up. When employee satisfaction increases, so does production. Production increases profits. And next, you'll be asking my advice on how to ask for a promotion. There are so many more ways that you as leaders can serve as better allies to your BIPOC employees. These tips are merely the tip of the iceberg. These are steps that we can take today. All of us can take today to live a more inclusive lifestyle and also be a more inclusive leader. So, you know, he's checking out her foot and doing all that stuff, you know, and having her stand on one leg and hop around and blah, blah, blah. And then they finally go back and they do the x-ray. Comes back a short time later, x-ray turns out negative. And what the issue is, according to him, is that she has just some really bad shin splints. He says, you know, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to take at least 1 week's rest from sports. And right now she's in soccer and she's in volleyball, right? So she loves sports. And so she was a little let down by that. But, you know, she's happy and relieved that that there's a diagnosis and there's a potential remedy for all this, right? Yeah, so a week off from sports and also a week off from gym class. As we get ready to wrap up, he says, I'm going to go to the front and I'm going to type up an excuse letter that you can give to your coaches and that you can give to your school to excuse you from these activities for a week. We're in the room for like one more second or, you know, one more minute rather. Comes back, gives me the excuse letter. Immediately, I just hand it off to my daughter. And then we leave. We leave the room. Wave goodbye to the clinic staff, walk out, get in the car, right? So my daughter's riding shotgun, I'm in the front seat, I start the car, but before I back out, you know, I'm like checking my work email or I'm doing something on my phone before I leave. And my daughter, she looks at me and she goes, Dad, with like a real serious face. I'm like, oh shoot. Something's going on. And she reads to me the letter that the physician typed up. Okay. And I'm not going to, I mean, it's like three sentences long, but I got one sentence into the letter and I realized that there was a huge problem. So here it goes. I'm just going to read this, the one sentence. I'm going to leave out my kid's name. To whom it may concern, a patient was seen in my clinic on 10/1/2020 and accompanied by her brother. Yo, accompanied by her brother. Now, some of you guys are watching this video right now and you're like, well, you look young. And hell, I'll admit it. Yeah, I do look young. Okay. But that's not the point. I was furious. I was so mad. I get out the car immediately. I snatch that letter, get out the car, go back in the clinic. I said, hey, I need to talk to the physician ASAP. Well, what's wrong? On this letter, he says that I'm her brother. And it's a small clinic, right? And they're like, oh, okay, we're sorry. We'll fix that, you know. But it's a small clinic, and I'm looking around. I'm trying to find this guy because I want to give him a piece of my mind. And, of course, he's nowhere to be found. But I was so mad. And if you're having a hard time understanding where the rage comes from, I'm going to do my best to try to break it down for y'all. It was just appalling to me that we were in this room with this dude for at least like 25 minutes. Why did he assume that I was her brother? He made a comment earlier. He said, wow, you're tall. And he goes, do you have tall parents? And then he looks at me and then he goes, is your mom tall? Right? So I assumed that he looked at me and saw a short guy and was like, is your mom tall? But before my daughter could answer, I said, well, her grandparents are tall. And he goes, oh, okay, you know, but still not thinking anything of it. So how is it that you have a patient in your room, there's some guy in the room with you and the patient, and you don't establish the relationship between the two? I thought that was very weird. Honestly, I thought it was unprofessional. But then it goes deeper. There is this ugly, ugly myth that black men don't take care of their children. That is not at all true. In fact, most of the black people that I know, literally most of the black people that I know, have had their moms and their dads in their lives, whether they were together or you know, whether the parents were together or whether they were separated, you know. Most of my black friends know and have relationships, intimate relationships with their fathers. But if you study history and if you study racist propaganda, you'll learn that this fabricated lie was intentionally created to create a certain concept and opinion about black people in this country. And so I'm just all these emotions, all these thoughts are running through my head. Like, do you think that this girl comes from a family where the dad just isn't around, so the brother has to do stuff? I mean, and then, yo, if you think that I'm her brother, are you taking this appointment as serious as it should be taken? Are you telling us the truth? Are you, you know, or are you holding back? Because, you know, I don't understand how the HIPAA and all that stuff works, but I mean, are you holding back because you assume that I don't have the legal right or the legal authority to hear what's going on? I mean, there's just so much, and even you could probably tell that even talking about it now, it kind of gets my blood boiling. I was very disappointed that happened. But I wanted to share that with you guys because, you know, especially for the allies out there that are interested in helping to make the lives better for the Black folk or for the other people of color within your communities or within your workspaces, I want to let you guys know that this is a real thing. It's real that Black women are treated very poorly within our medical system. It's also real that, well, it's not real, but there is a real myth out there of the absentee Black father. That is a myth. And I don't know, I almost want to call that clinic out. I should. But I'm not going to do that.
And how to program those things so that they can be fit. But all in all, we were just like, man, we want to give these kids more. And so Project Onyx was basically like a way that we could outreach, grab kids, not only give them the physical aspect, but the knowledge and then the representation and fields of things that we can do. And then the connections that we have that we can now assist to give the kids, you know, and just encouraging them that. So that's what Project Onyx is pretty much about. And like I said, man, it's right now we're a month in, and we've been having a blast, man.
Yeah. And I had an amazing opportunity to stop by the gym for a few minutes. And I think I saw maybe around like 12 Black kids or so. What were their age ranges? Were their high school kids?
There are 13 to about, I think the oldest is 19.
Yeah.
Or 18, and a few that are 20, 21, but they are they're actually members at my gym that assist with Project Onyx. They're looking to get into the internship program, the empowerment program of Project Onyx, to kind of work with the kids and assist and help with them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, these guys, they're doing some heavy lifting. And I mean, these kids were, you guys must be doing a good job with these kids, because these kids were, they were jacked. They were all super strong, and they were working really hard. And I didn't see anybody complaining or anybody like slacking off. And I mean, it was a sight to see. And I love this program. I love that it's you know, not only just kind of focusing on that physical strength, but also focusing on that mental strength too. Describe the racial makeup of your neighborhood or your community growing up, and talk to me about like when you first became conscious of like race as even being a thing.
As you know and can relate to, I went to school in Johnson for, you know, my earlier grade school years. And so it was my parents' decisions to transfer me to Des Moines Public Schools, which I'm so grateful for, because they knew the importance also of, you know, being in a more diverse group of people. So in my neighborhood, I mean, the interesting thing is if you were to ask me about growing up, grade school, middle school, and, you know, whether there was discrimination, and I don't know if it was just being the age, and maybe it was an ignorance is bliss type thing, you know, but I feel like I never really was aware of any of that, you know, like racism. I didn't feel like too out of place most of the time. I guess going to Meredith and Hoover, you know, I feel like we had a good mix of people, you know, students. Yeah. So we had, you know, different groups, and I had a diverse group of friends, white, Black, Asian, everything. So Indian, you know, so I feel like, and I feel like when I tell people I'm from Iowa, they assume that I was one of the only few Black people, you know, obviously, but I always tell them, no, there's more, you know, Black people there than you think there are. Mm-hmm. But being aware, I mean, I think that there were times when I was younger, which I think a lot of girls growing up go through, is like wanting to be, I wouldn't say wanting to be white, but wanting to have more white features, maybe, you know, especially as young women. I think like I wanted straight hair, I wanted my hair, you know, silky, I wanted to be skinnier, you know, like my white friends were, you know. And I think that was kind of, I kind of had issues accepting my Black features sometimes, you know, during those adolescent ages, definitely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's just kind of like rammed down everybody's throats, you know, like all of the, you know, the Disney princesses and the toys that were marketed towards girls, you know, it was all about the bright blue eyes and the blonde hair and, you know, and so that's, I know that you definitely weren't alone in that because, you know, I can think of, you know, women in my family, you know, who when they were girls, they struggled with that and they only wanted to play with specific dolls and stuff like that. And, you know, it's, yeah, that's a serious thing for sure.
Mm-hmm,
for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. It is. But I think, but then I also felt being mixed, you know, it was kind of, I feel like there's also kind of that phase, maybe not everyone who is mixed race goes through it, but it's kind of like, oh, you're more one than the other, or you're not enough of this, you know, like, oh, you're not Black enough, or, you know, because she, oh, you're just mixed, you know, it's just kind of, that's like another thing that also was an issue as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that wraps up the best of The Only Tip in the Cookie, season one. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and stay tuned. We've got a lot of heat in store for this year coming up. Peace.